We will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order, and appreciate everybody being here. We're going to do overviews of all kinds of different gaming things today, and we're going to immediately depart from the agenda because we're working on some technical issues with Canterbury, and so. So we're going to have the Racing Commission come up and present to us first and hear what they have to say. And while we're doing that, do we have minutes from the other day?
Yep.
We have minutes. Does anybody feel like approving the minutes?
Uh-oh.
Representative Sanders moves approval of the minutes. Any questions, comment, debate, discussions on the minutes? Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Thank you, members. With that, we'll go to Mr. DePasquale and the Racing Commission. Welcome. Thank you for being
here.
Good
afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the
Mr. DePasquale, I'll interrupt you right away. I want to apologize to you because we need to get together, and it's my fault. I don't read email very well. So we will do that soon in the near future. So I want to apologize.
Thank you. I wasn't going to say anything.
Well, I saw people looking at me, so I figured I better say it. Thank you. Please proceed.
By way of introduction, I'm Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and Joe Skurdo, our Deputy Director. We were here at last week's meeting, so we got to know you a little bit from the stands. Welcome and congratulations to those of you who are new with the Commerce and Regulatory Reform Committee, and congratulations on your appointment. And I want to thank the committee for making the Racing Commission and the industry one of its first orders of priority in the new legislative session. I know that there are pressing matters of the economy and taxes and health care and transportation and the like. It's not atypical that racing commissions are the forgotten agencies in state government. But there's good reasons to pay attention to racing in Minnesota, even if you're not a fan. And if you're not, I hope you will become one. As you know, racing was introduced in the state in 1982 by overwhelming support of the voters in constitutional amendment. And this body enabled the Racing Commission in 1983 legislation. Racing was introduced to help agricultural and agribusiness interests, to generate public revenues, to create jobs and economic development, and to add to the mix of entertainment and tourism and leisure in the state of Minnesota. Therefore, it's important to ask ourselves periodically whether our public policy is promoting those interests, and if not, why not? And we'll talk about that more. The other reason that our activities are important is because racing is a highly regulated activity conducted by private parties, and ensuring compliance and maintaining the integrity of the game is in the interest of all parties, as is protection of the public health, welfare, and safety. I'm learning that regulation of racing is a very complicated job. It's a complex and specialized area of the law. The rules are complex. I heard the other day that there are more financial transactions in the parimutuel industry than there are on Wall Street each day. They're smaller in amount, no doubt, but tracking them can be very difficult and challenging. Because there's money involved, there are those who are prone to gaining a competitive edge in illegal ways, and they always try to stay a step ahead of the regulators. So a lot of our job is ensuring that we can detect their methods and take appropriate enforcement action when the situation calls for it. So another question is whether the commission is adequately resourced to protect the public interest and the integrity of racing, and we'll talk about that. Let me step back for a second. For those of you that are not familiar with the commission, we have 9 commissioners appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. They serve for 6-year terms, and there are 3 commission spaces open for appointment in June of this year. We have a staff of ten full-time employees. In addition to Mr. Skurdo and myself, we have a licensing staff that licenses over 5,000 individuals and businesses per year. We have a Breeders Fund administrator. We have an investigative function, and we have a parimutuel auditing function. We also have seasonal employees and contractors that include the judges and stewards that regulate racing, the chief veterinarian, and her staff. We also had 3 hires in 2014. Joe was one of them. He comes from Illinois, has an extensive background in finance, accounting, operational management, and his skills were badly needed at the commission, and he has greatly assisted with our operational discipline in our day-to-day business. We also get support from the small agency resource team on both the HR side and finance. I want to tell you what I found in December of 2013 when I arrived at the commission as executive director and how we've addressed the issues that were before us then. We had a commission that was often divided and sometimes at war with itself. We had a former deputy director who had been on administrative leave for some time and was suing the commission for gender discrimination and violation to the open meeting law. We had a highly committed staff, but one that was demoralized by an absence of strong leadership and advocacy on behalf of the commission. As I mentioned, there was an absence of operational discipline in our day-to-day business affairs. We had, and we still have, an IT system that repeatedly fails due to outdated hardware and programming and has caused inefficiencies in our monitoring and oversight of gambling activities. We had a purse dispute between Running Aces and its horse people that had gone on for far too long without resolution. And we had then, and we still have, a structural budget deficit that required emergency infusion of money from the legislature last year and that requires our ongoing attention in the next biennium. Most of these issues are behind us or are in the process of being addressed. The commission has outstanding leadership through Chairman Ralph Stranges, who would have liked to have been here today, but he's away on travel, and the government's appointment of new commissioners that have brought needed expertise and professionalism to the commission. The former deputy director's lawsuit was resolved. It was settled in early 2014. The staff is still highly committed. We were given, one of the staff members was given a long overdue promotion. Two investigators have been recently reclassified into a more appropriate job level within state government, and we have hired a person with a master's in criminal justice who will also bring needed investigator and special project skills to the commission. As I mentioned, we hired Mr. Skurdo in the summer of this year, and the discipline and operational management that he brought to the commission was reflected in the recent Office of Legislative Auditors audit, which took a look at our financial compliance over the last couple years and found that we were compliant with state law and internal controls. The purse dispute, as I mentioned, was resolved with full restitution of purse payments that were in arrears. Those payments will be made over the next 3 years, and there's a residual amount that has been given to the Horse Persons Organization for marketing and promotion of ownership and breeding of standardbreds in Minnesota. On the negative side of the ledger, our IT systems continue to fail. We were down for 9 consecutive days of licensing during the November-December time period, which is the peak of our licensing operations. And so our offices were unavailable for licensing, and for a state agency whose principal responsibility is to license participants in the sport, that's unacceptable. And we're taking steps to address the problems with our licensing system. We still have a significant budget problem, which will lead me to a discussion of our proposals in this year's legislation. I also want to just make you aware of a situation that is before the Court of Appeals, so I'm going to be somewhat circumspect in what I say about it. But the commission was involved in a fairly lengthy investigation of a longtime licensee, owner, breeder in Minnesota. Our licenses have to be renewed annually, so when the application was made in May of 2014, we undertook an investigation to determine the suitability of this particular applicant. We found through several months of investigation he was not suitable. We afforded him all the process that was due, including a 5-hour hearing before our compliance committee, at which he was represented by counsel. There was a subsequent commission meeting where, again, he was represented by counsel and given an opportunity to be heard. And the commission voted unanimously with the unanimous support of staff and Canterbury's Director of Security to deny this person a license. That case is now on appeal before the Court of Appeals, and you'll probably hear more about that. You may also be aware that this person was the one whose breeding farm went up in flames a couple of weeks ago. That's been reported in the local media, and there's an investigation going on right now through the state fire marshal to determine the cause of that fire. Let me turn now to the commission's budget. The commission's operations are financed by racetrack and occupational license fees that are subject to direct appropriation by the legislature from the commission's special revenue fund. This amounts to about $800,000 a year, and if you've got our 2013 report, which, by the way, is going to be updated in February of this year, if you turn to page 13, you'll see toward the bottom of the page, I think about the third line from the bottom, the historical revenues that have been derived from licensing fees. And they typically amount to somewhere between $750,000 and $800,000 a year. So that's been flat for many years. Also, the license fees in our state have been subject to a statutory ceiling of $100 per licensee. So that includes both individuals, all the occupational licensees, as well as larger corporations that provide gaming equipment, the tote systems, and other vendor services to the tracks. Chapter 142 sets out a ceiling on appropriations to the commission from the special revenue fund of $899,000 a year, and that ceiling has been in place since at least 1999. So we have limited revenues through license fees and a ceiling on the total amount of our operational budget. The commission's operational budget exceeded that $899 cap in fiscal years 2014 and 15, and it's projected to do so into the next biennium as well. And as I mentioned, it was only through the special appropriations that were given to us last year that we're able to meet our budget limitations. The second source of revenue is a reimbursement account by which the tracks reimburse the commission to finance the costs of the stewards, the judges, the veterinarians, and their staff, and the cost of the outside laboratory, which does medication testing for the commission. We're also allowed to gain reimbursement for the direct costs of overseeing the card rooms. So just to give you an idea of the burden that's been placed on the associations through this reimbursement account, in 2012, the reimbursement level from Canterbury was $584,000. In 2015, it was $922,000. And it's continuing to increase. On Running Aces, the reimbursement account moved from $444,000 in 2012 to $792,000 in 2015. And finally, the commission gets a very small statutory appropriation to reimburse us for the cost of administering the Breeders' Fund to Minnesota horsemen and women who compete at both tracks. So the structural imbalance between the operating budget anticipated to be $1.1 million this year and available license fee revenues threatens to compromise the commission's ability to meet its statutory obligations. This closed-loop funding scheme, whereby all the monies that come for regulatory oversight and operation of the commission come from the associations themselves and from the industry itself, is fairly unique in the United States. Most racing commissions get some level of general revenue support from their legislators. This places increasing burdens on the racetracks, as I've mentioned, and it places limits on our regulatory oversight and business operations in several ways. The historical underinvestment in IT systems and the lack of automation for racing commission procedures was pointed out by the OLA office in a 2005 audit, and it was mentioned again in the most recent audit by the commission. Just while I mentioned the license system being down for 9 days, the other limitation we have is on legal support. We get the entirety of our legal support from the Attorney General's office, and due to budget constraints, our budget for the new biennium, which increases legal fees by a small amount, We've been historically limited to about 1/6 to 1/10 of a full-time equivalent. And this is in comparison to racing commissions who have full-time lawyers on their staffs around the United States. In addition, the statutory framework itself provides a vigorous financial disincentive for vigorous enforcement since contested case costs are borne by the commission. So to give you an idea, the statute limits the stewards and judges' enforcement authority to suspension of 90 days for a licensee and imposition of a $2,000 fine. If the commission wants to take any greater enforcement action than that, by definition under the statute, it's a contested case. And those costs can approach $10,000, and whatever monies we recoup through an enforcement action go to the general revenue fund. So we're spending $10,000 out of a limited budget in order to capture a couple of $1,000s, which we receive no benefit from, other than the deterrent effect, of course, to violations of our laws. So now let me move on to solutions. Those are some of the challenges that we face at the commission. To address the situation, the commission is considering several proposals, most of which would require changes to Chapter 240. First of all, we're looking at the option of multi-year licensing for certain occupational classes, primarily owners, those people who deserve or need very little regulatory oversight. They're required to come to commission offices every year in order to renew their licenses. Many of them are Minnesota residents, and they've been owners for many years. So in order to better serve our customers, to reduce administrative costs, and to provide an immediate cash flow benefit to the commission, we're looking at three-year licenses for owners and perhaps other categories of licensees. We're also recommending removing the statutory ceiling of $100 on license fees. Obviously, this would need to go through a rulemaking, so it would go through discussion, notice and comment, discussion with the governor's office, and input from those parties that would be affected. We're considering or would like to raise fees on a select group of gaming equipment vendors and distributors who, when you look at other jurisdictions, pay $1,000, $1,500, $5,000, and even $15,000 for licenses to do business to sell gambling equipment and devices to our card rooms and to provide the tote service to the tracks. By comparison, they do business in Minnesota for $100. And we think that ceiling needs to be lifted. We also think that the $899 cap on appropriation should be lifted to better reflect operating budget realities of the commission. And finally, we would like the state to consider either general appropriations to the commission or to provide a portion of the $1 million in sales taxes that are paid by the association sales and use taxes that are generated by the two tracks, to pay a portion of that to the commission to fund its regulatory oversight. We anticipate that these and other legislative reforms will be coming your way in the next few weeks, and there may be other reforms as well. That are mainly cleanup of the statute, which has been badly in need of some reform over the last several years, and some other initiatives that will assist us to create a level playing field for racing in Minnesota. Lastly, I'd like to turn to a critical issue facing Minnesota's racing industry, and that is the impact of advanced deposit wagering, or what's known as account wagering. Advanced deposit wagering is a form of paramutual wagering in which a person establishes an account with a licensed entity or a wagering hub where the account owner provides wagering instructions that authorize that entity holding the account to place wagers into the paramutual pools of races around the country. Winnings are then credited to the account holder. Obviously, losings are debited to the account. And the wagers are ultimately placed electronically in the track's tote system and are part of the commingled pools on the race. ADW accounts for an increasing share of paramutual wagering in the United States, and they're flourishing for a number of reasons. First of all, it's very convenient to bet. You bet through this little machine, and it is wherever you are. So even if you're at the track, If you're at a large event, for example, rather than standing in line for a half an hour to place a wager, it takes 15 seconds to do it on this, which allows you to enjoy your time at the track a lot more than you would otherwise. These companies also offer generous rebates to large bettors, and that's one of the reasons they're siphoning players away from the tracks in favor of staying at home or betting off-site. And I think Canterbury and Running Aces will tell you that many of their large players are not seen as frequently or even at all at the track because they're enjoying the conveniences of ADW wagering. And finally, these companies enjoy minimal, or like Minnesota, no regulation. Their competitive advantages allow them to siphon wagering handle from what would otherwise be wagered at the track and what would otherwise benefit Minnesota's horsemen and women and the associations themselves. So the public policy question here is what to do about it. We can continue to ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist, which is a little bit like pretending that everybody still buys their books at brick-and-mortar bookstores and nobody uses Amazon.com. The disadvantage of that is that these companies are not licensed, they're not regulated, the paramutuals that they are involved in are not audited, and their activities don't benefit racing in Minnesota. And in fact, work to the disadvantage of Minnesota, because there are ADW wagering entities that open accounts on behalf of Minnesota residents, and Minnesota residents can bet on every race in the country except those being conducted in our own state. So we have a situation where we have, in an online world, an off-track industry, and one of the only off-internet industries that exists in the United States. In 2014, this situation was brought to the attention of Arkansas legislators. They have a racing industry similar to ours. They've got one thoroughbred track, a greyhound track. It's similar in size. In 2014, the Arkansas legislature passed ADW-enabling legislation by an 84-0 vote in the House and a 35-0 vote in the Senate. In 2014, Arkansas-licensed ADWs generated $9.1 million in wagers, which more than offset the $5 million decline in live and simulcast wagers. The explosion of internet gambling in general and internet paramutual wagering in particular compels us to acknowledge it and to regulate it. And I would submit that continuing to ignore it would be a failure of our duty to maintain the integrity of racing itself in Minnesota, and I believe it demands a responsible public policy approach. So we intend to submit a bill shortly that will have ADW components to it and provide a mechanism for regulating it and ensuring that the state of Minnesota benefits from it. So the last thought I would like to leave you with is I want to make it a priority to have a productive two-way dialogue with members of this committee over the course of the session to make sure that as we act, we carry out your legislative intent. That's our primary responsibility, and that we inform your judgment with the subject matter expertise that we have as members of the Racing Commission. So I invite you to have that dialogue. I'm happy to meet with any of you, and Mr. Skirdo would as well, and any member of the commission at your convenience. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. If there are difficult questions, and those are the ones that have dollar signs attached to it, that's why Mr. Skirdo's here. He can address those better than I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DePasquale. Mr. Skirdal, do you want to say anything to the committee?
No, I'm happy to answer questions, though, if any of the committee members have them.
Any questions from any members? Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. DePasquale, going to a three-year license, the owners that come to the track, the turnover, I'm assuming, is very low. The same ones come back all the time?
Particularly in Minnesota, we have about 2,000 individual licensees, and many of those are repeat licensees. They can get their license to a certain point online, then they have to come into our office to be badged. And oftentimes what we find is Minnesota residents are coming in the fourth race on opening day because they have a horse running in the fifth race. And it's a mad scramble in the commission offices to license them. Giving them three-year licenses will allow it to happen in a more leisurely and orderly way.
Mr. Chairman, where I was going with that is that if you, with the three-year licensing, there's no expected effect as far as a drop in owners that would come and license here. For instance, making a value decision, if I'm only going to come here 1 year and run, is it worth it to go for a three-year license? You don't expect any effect.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would maintain the option to have a one-year license if that's what people wanted.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll just ask you one quick question about the IT system. Are you working with the state IT with Minute on that, or is that a separate entity?
Mr. Chair, we have been working with the IT from the start. Okay. I think relations with them have improved. There have been some personnel changes and reassignments that have been to our benefit. And I'm going to let Mr. Skurdo describe work we're doing on a new licensing system to move away from the state's licensing system.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as far as working, we do work
Mr. Skurdo, could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. Joe Skurdo, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission.
Thank you.
We are currently working with Minute for most of our IT needs. We are looking for more industry-specific software applications that we can use that would cut our costs. One of the first things we saw when we started was that our budget for Minute was about $200,000 a year. And when you're looking at an overall operational budget of $900,000, that was eating up quite a bit. So we are definitely pursuing alternatives to that so that we can cut the overhead in our IT, yet we need to improve it.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Canterbury, are you guys ready with the we'll check with our technical expert, Sam. I think we're good to go.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, sir. And members of the Commerce Committee, I appreciate the opportunity today, and it's great when this stuff works, right? I'm always not so sure, but so thank you for the opportunity today. I'll make some comments about Canterbury Park. We've got some exciting things going on and a challenge. I'm going to reinforce the discussion that Mr. DePasquale started about ADWs and fill in a few blanks there. I do have, we provided a lot of information in the colorful folder that you have, and there is a PowerPoint, all the slides. There's a lot of information in these slides, so I'm gonna just try to hit the high points, but you have the full document to look at.
And Mr. Sampson, before you go any further, we do have a couple of freshmen on the committee, so if you could identify yourself for
record.
So no worries.
Randy Sampson, I'm the CEO of Canterbury Park Holding Corporation. So this first slide is just some background, and I know as Mr. DePasquale mentioned, we're a highly regulated industry in horse racing, both in Minnesota and around the country. A couple of things I'll highlight off of this about Canterbury, the fact that most people don't realize that we're a publicly held company. That means people can buy shares of Canterbury stock, and so we have lots of shareholders, most of whom are Minnesota residents. The other thing off of this slide that I wanted to highlight was the jobs. Mr. DePasquale mentioned that as part of the reason for initially authorizing horse racing. We have now over 600 employees year-round at Canterbury. We have over 1,000 seasonally during our live racing season, and I also want to point out that that's the count for Canterbury employees. We also have an entire backside full of trainers, jockeys, grooms, exercise riders, and other people that work with the horses, as well as other vendors that work at Canterbury that are not counted in that number. And we've always estimated that would be, you know, roughly another 1,000 people that are working at the racetrack in addition to the employees. The next thing I wanted to start with is you know, for years in our legislative efforts and discussions, we talked about, you know, the need to improve purses as a way to benefit horse racing, and, you know, that was always our pitch and discussion when we talked about legislative efforts over the years to try to improve the horse racing industry. Purses drive the success of horse racing. Increased purses result in better horses, bigger fields, which results in more fan interest and translates into handle and attendance increases, as you'll see in some of the additional slides. It provides a much better opportunity for return on investment of the owners and breeders as those purses increase. The purses, for those that aren't familiar, are when a horse owner runs in a race and the horse wins second or third, they are paid a fee for running in that race, and that is the purse. And it is, again, what drives the whole industry. And also, as Mr. DePasquale mentioned, I want to highlight that the horse racing industry really is agriculture, equine. There's jobs, there's hay, straw, grain, veterinary services, construction of barns. There's a lot, you know, tack, all sorts of economic activity that results from a healthy horse industry. The next slide is, this goes all the way back. This is an interesting slide because it shows such a direct correlation between purses and the Minnesota breeding industry over the history since 1985 when the track opened. The green line is purses, total purse payments adjusted for inflation, and the black bars are the actual thoroughbred foal counts, which is really probably the easiest way, at least, to measure how the health of the industry. And so you can see when the purses go up, the breeding industry improves, and on the, you know, conversely, as it declines. You can see the period there in 93 and 94 when racing was closed. We reopened in 94. You can see in 2000 when the card room was passed and increasing purses and how that did translate into additional breeding industry. After 2007, 2008, for a number of reasons, the purses began to decline and the breeding industry with it, to a point where in the spring of 2012, we were in very desperate situation with less than 100 thoroughbred foals born in Minnesota, and really a question about the future viability of racing in Minnesota. You'll see in 12 that the purses went up, even though the breeding industry went down. The purses went up after the spring foaling season. And then, so you'll see under 100 in 2012, and immediately in 2013, that number jumped 160% to about 260 foals. And the reason is the next slide is related to our cooperative marketing agreement between Canterbury Park and Mystic Lake and Shakopee, Midwakan, and Sioux community that has been literally saved horse racing, thoroughbred and quarter horse racing in Minnesota, has put us on a solid foundation and given us a real future for horse racing in Minnesota. So as you can see on the slide, in June of 2012, after years of acrimony and being on the opposite sides of the gaming debate in Minnesota, Canterbury Park, along with Shakopee, Midwakan, and Sioux community, the owners of Mystic Lake Casino, worked out a 10-year cooperative marketing agreement where the SMSC Mystic Lake would subsidize our purse program to allow for a healthy horse industry and also provide marketing dollars to help a joint marketing effort between the two entities. The next slide shows the annual payments that were, you know, 3 years into, or coming up on 4 years into the payment stream. You can see how they increase over time to help us grow the industry. The next slide shows on a per race basis for thoroughbreds and quarter horses, the trajectory of our purses since signing this agreement, where we were in 2010, the 2012. We were, you know, in the around 50th in the country in terms of our purse level compared to other tracks and thoroughbred tracks, and we anticipate we're around 25 to 30 now and hope to get into potentially the top 20 when the agreement is fully implemented. The agreement also had marketing components to it that have been very helpful. We have made some capital investments. We've been able to spend significantly more on some new promotions and marketing and joint advertising. And we've also been able to dramatic. You know, just the fact that now we're working together has changed the dynamics completely in our community, and what once was difficult to work together on joint efforts, now we're very much side by side, and in lots of community sponsorship events, and most importantly, the recent announcement of River South, which I'll mention briefly. This is a copy of, or a picture of, our new tote board, which was one of the most visual, or the most impactful results of our agreement. We have a state-of-the-art tote board with video and better graphics and all kinds of whistles and bells that allows us to be more competitive with the other types of stadiums in town. Has been a fantastic improvement in our customer or fan experience. We also put up a new music stage as part of the, in providing more entertainment, again, to help the fan experience, provide more entertainment. So the result so far of the purse enhancement and cooperative marketing is that there certainly is an interest in Canterbury Park Live Racing is on the upswing. You can see the various measurements and metrics we've showing here that we're now 2010, by the way, was the last year that we had a full season prior to the 2012 because of the 2011 shutdown of racing for about a month. So going back to comparison to 2010, we're up about 10% in the number of days we're running, 13% in races, attendance up 19% to 432,000 people. The most important line item here would be the purses, which are up 80%. You can see, within the next couple of years, we will have doubled purses from where they were prior to the agreement. The next item is interesting. The total unique horses racing means that how many or what different horses actually raced at Canterbury. Again, this is significant in terms of the horse industry, agriculture, hay, straw, oats. In 2010, there were 1,000 different horses that were stabled at Canterbury and raced during the course of the year. In 2014, there were 1,600, and we have 1,600 stalls, so that indicates that we were full and had great participation in racing, and again, as a result, more going back into the agricultural economy here by having that many more horses active and training in Minnesota. On-track wagering up, and then the final number there is another impressive increase, the out-of-state wagering up 84%. That means people in other states that are betting on Canterbury's races, and this really is the best, and over this period of time, the total handle from that type of simulcasting is declining, as you'll see in a future slide. So this is very much in going against the grain in terms of where the industry is going, and to have an 84% increase really dramatically shows how much our racing has improved over this time. The River South I mentioned, it's not really relevant to the gaming issue, but I at least wanted to mention that it is a regional marketing effort that really grew out of our cooperative marketing agreement with Mystic. We're now partnering with Valley Fair Renaissance, also the City of Shakopee and Prior Lake and SMSC to form a marketing group that we think is going to be great in terms of promoting this unique entertainment corridor that we have in Scott County. Next thing I wanted to mention is thanking the members of the legislature back in 2012 at the same time we were working out the agreement with Mystic Lake. The legislature passed a purse enhancement bill that had two components to it, which I wanted to update the committee on. The first portion of that bill was to enhance our card room opportunities, essentially to give us a better chance to meet the customer demand. We were artificially limited by statute to 50 tables. That has been increased. We currently operate about 65 tables. They're not always in use, obviously, but we have the ability, much more flexibility, to meet our peak demand times, increase in betting limits, and more tournaments. We're also part of that we have implemented and been, again, successful in being able to give the customers what they're looking for. The second piece of this, of the legislation, was a authorization to allow simulcast racing at the Minnesota Tribal Casinos. Simulcast racing means watching on TV races all around the country. that and being able to make wagers on those races. But the legislation stated was that the racetracks, Class A racetracks, could contract with a tribal government and with MRC approval of that contract could implement simulcasting at the tribal casinos. So far we haven't actually accomplished that, but we are making progress. We've got a great partner that's excited to have this opportunity. We're excited to work with Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Was the first group to indicate an interest, and so in February of last year we signed an agreement with them. As you can see, they would retain sole proprietary interest in the operation. We would provide management assistance, and there would be a portion that would go to purses. We have submitted this to the National Indian Gaming Commission. I should say Leech Lake has submitted the agreement to the National Indian Gaming Commission. It has taken incredibly long to go through that federal process, and we're hoping to get an answer here soon. And assuming we get hopefully we will get approval, and at that point it will be submitted to the Racing Commission for their review and hopefully approval. And if, you know, we still would love to be able to, the biggest part of the year for racing is the spring with the Kentucky Derby and Triple Crown races, and so we would certainly hope to be able to have this operation up and running by this spring. I won't go through this slide other than to say that this generally lays out, you know, what Canterbury's responsibilities would be in terms of kind of the technical side and contracting with the host tracks, and then the casino would be responsible for the setup of the facility and hiring the labor to manage it. We do see this as a great win-win proposition and are quite hopeful for the outcome of this. It will allow us to expose horse racing statewide. Right now, with only two places in Minnesota where you can go to make a wager, it limits the ability for a lot of Minnesotans to participate in the exciting sport of horse racing. And so we hope that additional exposure will be a positive for racing. It'll provide another entertainment option for the casinos, and it will also generate some additional purse money to help the horse industry. So we see this as something that we're still very excited about. The last area I wanted to discuss, and Mr. DePasquale covered this, so I will just hit a couple of high points. We do have, in addition to the positive things I've mentioned, a real challenge facing us with this advanced deposit wagering, which, as Mr. DePasquale mentioned, it is you put the money in an account and then you wager via the internet or the phone. One of the complications here is that the federal action really opened up the door for all of these sites to be able to take wagering. So this is one case where the federal government has made it difficult for states to really manage their gaming policy because of the federal authorization. As was mentioned, these sites aggressively compete for the high volume customers. We absolutely have seen a number of our customers, great number of customers that either come less or don't come at all. And when we ask what's going on, they tell us that they're betting online instead of the drive to the track. This is an example. The daily racing form, for those of you that are involved in racing, it's hieroglyphics if you're not, but it's got all of the past performance information that you need to be able to make a wager. We sell these for $7.50 to our customers that want to come out and handicap and bet the races. The cover of this, which used to have pictures of horses and headlines of articles every day, now says $500 cash bonus if you sign up for DRF bets, and including we'll give you free past performances. So this indicates the challenge that right in our building they're poaching our customers. As was mentioned, the concerns that this creates are regulation, which Mr. DePasquale mentioned. I'm gonna talk a little bit more specifically on this capturing revenue for the horse industry. When somebody comes out today and bets on a race at Santa Anita or Aqueduct from New York or Gulfstream from Florida, a portion of that revenue goes towards purses and a portion goes to help support Canterbury's operations and expenses. When that same person stays home and wagers on the internet, zero money comes to the local economy and to the local horse industry. It all goes to the account deposit wagering or internet wagering company. And as a result, since they don't have to pay purses and they don't have to pay salaries and all the expenses we have, regulatory costs and everything else, they are able to offer huge rebates to their customers. So in terms of our ability to compete, they not only have a convenience advantage, they have a significant cost advantage that allows them to really reduce the cost of those wagers to their customers. It is an issue that is getting more and more significant. This is a visual of the Minnesota simulcast handle on Thoroughbred and Quarter Horse Racing, and it does include both Canterbury and Running Aces handle on the simulcast. You can see dramatic drop, in fact, about half of where we were in 2004, where we are today. So we've seen a huge decline. There's no way of knowing right now in Minnesota how much ADW handle, because it really isn't regulated and tracked, but we believe that the vast majority of the loss of business that we've seen is going to internet wagering. And to reinforce that, Tom DePasquale mentioned the increasing ADW market share. This is a chart that shows that visual, where you can see the total handle with the blue bars, stagnant over the last few years, but flat, and the red line is the percentage of the market share for ADW, which you can see is dramatically increasing, and within the next couple of years there will be more, at least the next 5 years, more money bet through ADWs than there will at racetracks around the country. So in summary, we're very pleased to see the rebirth and popularity of racing and the energy that's been created by the SMSC agreement and increase in purses. We're looking forward to a great meet in 2015 with some exciting things on the schedule. But we are certainly concerned about the existing ADW model that allows wagers to be taken from Minnesota residents with no benefit to the Minnesota horse industry is a significant threat to our long-term future. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions from any members, if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Representative Swudzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Just from a comparison standpoint, you look at Canterbury Downs versus, like, a Churchill Downs. You know, how does that equate from a volume scale, from a standpoint? I mean, I think everyone probably knows down in Kentucky, Kentucky Derby. How, from a business standpoint, you say you got 600 jobs on site all times, and then through the summer season, the race season, you have 1,000. How does that compare to other racetracks around the country? And then I have a follow-up question.
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swudzinski, I would be, anything I say would be my guess and anecdotal, but in terms of the volume of handle, Churchill's in a different stratosphere because of the Kentucky Derby. On the other hand, most of the tracks in Chicago and the various regional tracks are not significantly different than Canterbury in terms of the number of jobs. In fact, that's one thing that takes a certain number of people to run the operation, to run a racing day, and most of the handle that those guys are getting is out of state anyway. So your on-track operations aren't as much different as you would think. And also a lot of those jobs are related to the card room, which is kind of unique to our situation too.
Okay. And then just the second, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the second question, kind of, you talked about profitability and kind of the ranking down. So obviously the guy that wins a race are going to come home with the largest purses. Is the purse setup system, to say if you've got, a track guy a racer or a stable that is a routinely low returner, he comes in sixth every day or eighth every day, where is their profitability standpoint? Do these guys wash out? Or is this purse setup system set so that even the last place guy still is bringing enough revenue to keep his operation going?
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swudzinski, first, there's a wide variety of types of races, lower level horses and cheaper horses. If they're so you don't have to have $1 million horses to be competitive. There are races for lower level horses, and if you're winning those races, you can make some money, pay your bills. Previously, where we were at in the purses prior to the Mystic Lake Agreement, it really was a case where virtually everybody was losing money, and you were seeing turnover in the industry and people having, you know, a difficult time trying to justify staying in the business. So, but with the increased purses, you still have to win. You know, there is a purses get spread down to the bottom, but you're not gonna pay your bills unless you finish in the top two or three. In general, the way the horse industry works is that most of the people that race horses do spend more training and buying those horses than they take in. But the incentive is that there's always the guy, the California Chrome, the $20,000 horse that wins $10 million or is worth $10 million. That's the dream and the upside that keep people excited about being in the sport.
Representative Swidzinski, last question, and if you're going to ask for a tip on that one, I don't think that's going to work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, just kind of a general from a draw standpoint. You mentioned some of the Chicago and some of the other kind of more regional tracks. Would you say, you know, there's a lot of internet stuff, so a lot of people don't necessarily travel, but, you know, as a percentage of business, do you feel like there's a group or a clientele that does travel through the country to go to different tracks to bet? And, you know, like you bring people in from Chicago, or is it strictly more of a regional? You kind of, the people that are betting are coming to you and they're not going other places, or other places aren't coming to you, you know, that kind of a cross-border type of scenario.
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swidzinski, first. In terms of the horse owners and horses moving around, they very much travel. The horses that run at Canterbury run in Florida or Arizona or Arkansas during the winter, and a lot of those owners are from out of state and move horses to wherever the tracks are. In terms of the wagering, other than when you do a big tournament or some, you know, they're going to stay local. The guy in Chicago, if he wants to bet Canterbury, will go to the local OTB or he'll go online and he'll bet the Canterbury races from there. You know, the system set up that he doesn't have to really drive to Canterbury just to play the horse. So it is very much a regional draw in terms of our customers that are wagering on racing.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sampson. I appreciate your testimony. With regards to the advanced deposit wagering, the ADW, is it primarily, I'll just call them the high rollers that are using this, and you're just seeing more volume in terms of the amount of money placed as wagers that is affecting, or is it more persons using this type of method for placing bets?
Mr. Sampson.
Chairman Hoppe, Commissioner Loon, it is both. The most noticeable are the high volume customers that there are, like in most business, there's certain people that wager a lot, and typically they're the ones that study the most and have the most knowledge about the racing, and they are very much targeted because of the economics. When they make a bet at Canterbury, you know, we can, through our economics, we can rebate them 1% or whatever on a wager, and some of the ADWs will rebate them 10 or 15%. So if you're a large wagerer, that's a huge difference and a great incentive. On the smaller bettors, there isn't really much of a rebate, but it's a convenience issue that in the winter, do I want to drive out to Canterbury or just log on or play from my phone, you know, from my phone at work or whatever. So it's across the board, but generally the most noticeable impact for us and the main targeting of the offshore and the large ADWs is the high volume players.
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Blue.
Thank you. Just one follow up. You mentioned that other states that have addressed this with some regulations on that. Could you talk about some of the specifics and, you know, how long have some of those regulatory schemes been in place from the states and how well it's working in some of the other horse racing interests in other states?
Mr. Sampson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, Representative Loon. There's a variety of ways that it's been handled. In some states, they just flat out legalized it to be able to regulate and tax it. In other states, they've more tried to capture what they call source market fees, where the ADW that's taking wagers in Minnesota is required to pay money into the horse industry. In our case, the way we're in this no man's land, where because the legality is uncertain in Minnesota, we can't even collect source market fees. So there's a number of ways. I can't say that that there's a magic answer to this one at all. It's a difficult problem. I am very pleased that the current commission staff is engaged in the issue. They're very much trying. They're doing exactly what you're asking. Looking at other states, looking at examples. We're all trying to find models that are working out there. And, you know, I believe that there can be a solution. I believe it's probably going to require some legislative enablement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sampson. Question about with the increase of nurses and now that stable space is full on the backside, are you seeing a more competitive sort of environment for trainers to bring their stable horses to Minnesota, or is it pretty much stabled out and we're going to get what we're going to get?
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. The first answer to that is absolutely it got far more competitive, where before we'd take any horses that would come, and even if there weren't ones that maybe looked like they were going to win or fit, now we have the ability to be more selective and try to get a better quality of horse and better stables. It certainly is not an easy situation because you got people that have been loyal through the years that maybe have the cheaper horses, and you don't want to just throw them out because now you've got some better stables, and so you find a balance. You know, it has worked itself out. In terms of going forward, I think it kind of is what it is now, although even this year in our recruiting, we've got a couple of several nice stables from around the country that haven't raced here in the past that are talking about coming this year. So,
thank you. And Representative Loonan, and then I think we're going to move on. We're going to start running out of time.
Thank you, Chairman. The you had in your presentation about unique horse racing. Could you explain that?
Mr. Sampson.
Oh,
That, I think we were talking about the counting them as individual horses and not.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Loonan. It was confusing. What it refers to in terms of unique horses is how many different horses actually started at Canterbury this year, is what it means by just saying how many unique horses that we went from, you know, I mean, there's thousands of starts during the year because a lot of these horses will run five times, six times, eight times, but this was a measure to try to show that, you know, it isn't just the same horses running more. We actually have, you know, 60% more horses here that are participating in racing at Canterbury was what that unique figure referenced.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. I don't know, Representative Luna, if you were looking for zebras or purple horses or I don't know, but
no, I just wanted to say,
good question.
We do have unique races there. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Thank you, members, and we'll have the folks from Running Aces come down or come over. Whenever, Mr. Franzen, and whenever you're ready, feel free to jump right in.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for being for having us here today. My name is Doug Franzen with Franzen Law and Policy Group, doing business with Franzen More Government Relations, here on behalf of Running Aces. Along with me today, we have my colleague Vic Moore in the audience and John Darris, who is a member of our board of directors. But it's my honor to introduce Tracy Wilson, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Running Aces, who will present the bulk of our testimony, and I, as well as John and Vic, will be available for questions. But thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Ms. Wilson, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Hoppe. My name is Tracy Wilson, CFO with Running Aces Harness Park. Thank you, and I want to thank the members of this committee for the opportunity to be here today. I really feel like this is a privilege to get to tell you about Running Aces, who we are. Today, we would like to give you a little information about Running Aces and brief you on the steps we have taken to move Running Aces forward and the challenges that remain ahead. Who is Running Aces? Running Aces opened for harness racing on April 11, 2008. I remember that date vividly. We were opening the harness track for live racing to a snowstorm. that first inaugural year of live racing, we dealt a snow, rain, storms, you name it. And if you recall, 2008 was the year that the tornado touched down in Hugo. So it was definitely a tumultuous weather season for us, but we were able to hold and complete all of our races such that we could open up our kart room on June 30th, 2008. We hold live harness racing during the summer, and this year the meet will run June 6th through September 12th, and we run on Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. I hope to see you all there. Our property is located in the city of Columbus in Anoka County, approximately 20 miles north of Minneapolis and St. Paul on Interstate 35. We are the first exit after the 35W and 35E merge, and you maybe have seen that on your way towards Duluth or up north. We've got a huge digital billboard sign on the southbound 35 side. The facility and barns are situated on approximately 165 acres. We have a first-class 5/8 mile racetrack along with four barns and 300 stalls. The building is a 60,000 square foot state-of-the-art facility offering 24/7 entertainment with our 70-table card room consisting of 45 blackjack tables and other carnival game tables as well as 25 poker tables. We also offer year-round simulcast pari-mutuel wagering on other racetracks around the world. We have a year-round full-service restaurant and bar with seating for approximately 300 people. We also have an entertainment room with seating for approximately 250 people, where we hold various events, comedy shows, music, craft shows, host community and business events, and provide indoor live racing seating, food and beverage, and pari-mutuel tellers during the summer, and for those people that don't want to be outside. We do have an outdoor apron near the track, which also has seating, food, beverage, outdoor pari-mutuel self-service terminals, and can accommodate in excess of 3,000 people. We host other various outdoor entertainment events during the year, such as 5K runs, car shows, motorcycle rallies, haunted house events, and hay rides in October, celebrating Halloween. Our economic development impact. Our 2014 revenues were approximately $26.5 million, which 79% of those revenues were generated from the card room. 16% come from our food and beverage operations, and 5% are from racing and other. We employ approximately 550 employees year-round, with the addition of another approximate 100 employees during the summer. This translates to a total payroll of approximately $20 million. We offer employee benefits to our full-time employees. We pay taxes and fees of $3.8 million. This includes $1.8 million of employer taxes, $800,000 in property taxes, $900,000 in license fees, $300,000 in sales tax. We paid total purses from the card room, simulcast, and live racing of approximately $3 million. We generated $6.2 million of handle and harness live racing during 2014, representing 473 races held over 53 race days in 2014. We had an attendance of approximately 70,000 during the meet. We make significant contributions to the horse industry and the economic agricultural impact that standardbred racing brings to the state of Minnesota. The horse industry is far-reaching and not only includes the owners and trainers, but includes vets, grooms, blacksmiths, farmers, 4-H groups, and horse clubs, and so on. We are very committed to the city of Columbus and the surrounding area. Our community involvement, some of the things we do, We operate lawful charitable gaming on behalf of Lakes Area Youth Service Bureau, generating gross revenues of over $100,000 in 2014. We make an annual contribution of $84,000 to the City of Columbus to support law enforcement, fire department, parks, and general community support. We make charitable donations, sponsorships, and dues to organizations in excess of $40,000, consisting of direct financial donations, prize package donations, space and food donations, and playing card donations, such as we actually ship our cards overseas for the military to use our playing cards, and we have children. We send our cards to local schools for our children to actually learn how to count with our playing cards. We are also actively involved in 6 chambers, 3 associations, and 3 convention and visitor bureaus. Our history and our future. We opened in April 08, just prior to the financial meltdown beginning in September 08. As you recall, September 08, I believe that's when Lehman Brothers shut their doors. The secured debt holders foreclosed on the property in July 2010. New ownership purchased the company out of bankruptcy in July 10 and eliminated the debt. In January 14, we resolved a matter with the Minnesota Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, agreeing to pay $1.25 million. This is the thoroughbred association that races at Canterbury Park. We resolved a long-running dispute over handle purse contributions in August 14. To all parties' satisfaction, with Running Aces agreeing to pay the entire amount of $436,000 to our horsemen. We thank the Minnesota Racing Commission and the Office of Legislative Auditors for helping to bring this matter to a conclusion. We also want to thank Chair Atkins. I'm sorry I don't see him. Former Chair Atkins, and the committee that was here that heard our testimony this summer.
He's actually at Running Aces right now. We're not supposed to say that.
In August 2014, we reached a new all-breed simulcast agreement with Canterbury Park that had terminated in February 13. In 2012, this agreement provided approximately $500,000 of purses to the racing industry. We changed senior management in October 14. We have generated an operating loss in every year except one. That was 2012, since inception. In short, we need to develop additional sources of revenue to sustain harness racing in Minnesota. We may need your support and help to do this. This will be our 8th live racing season in 2015. We are now outside of the deepest recession I have seen in my lifetime, which has really hit the middle class hardest and their disposable entertainment dollars. We have made significant progress in 2014 with repairing relationships, resolving disputes, and changing top management. But we are in a very competitive gaming environment, and our ability to increase our existing revenues is limited, yet costs continue to increase. As one of the many employees and their families supported by Running Aces, I hope that the legislature recognizes the financial constraints that we continue to face and helps to assure the success of Running Aces and to protect the 550 year-round jobs, the 100 seasonal jobs in the summer, not to mention the economic impact we have on the community surrounding us and all of the horsemen and women and the agricultural industry in Minnesota. I look at the four corners of the Twin Cities metro area. In the northeast corner where we're located, it's growing, but it is much less developed than the other three quarters. We're a vital cog in the Northeast metro area, and I want us to be successful, as many people rely on us, including me. In closing, Running Jesus has been a major contributor to the economy of the Northeast metro area. We have created good-paying jobs and have paid thousands of dollars in taxes, fees, and purses. We are active in the community and support numerous charities and community events. We are an entertainment and dining destination for the greater North Metro area, and we are working hard to stay in business. We would like to thank Chairman Hoppe and the members of the Commerce Committee. We would like to invite you, and we do thank you, but we really would like to see you guys come out to the track this summer if you're able to. It's really a fun experience. It's very family friendly, and you're right there up close and personal to the horses. So we do invite you out and take a tour of our facility, and if you're out during live racing, you can also get a ride in the starter car, which is pretty exciting to have those horses lined up while you're in the back in the starter car. We're also grateful to Representative Atkins and several of the members and staff who visited us last year and the previous years. This legislative committee is responsible for commerce, and I sincerely appreciate and thank you for listening and learning more about who we are and what we mean to the Northeast metro area. Thank you.
Thank you Chair. Very much. Representative Swudzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of, I kind of asked this to Canterbury as well, and kind of the state of where other tracks like yours are in the country. You know, obviously, you mentioned kind of profitability has been lacking for most of the years of your operation, except for 2012. You know, what's going on across the country when it comes to your particular industry? And then what have they done in other places that maybe if it's different? There you go. So thanks. Is that clear?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I certainly don't have all of this history here. But I can tell you that, you know, the state of Ohio, they were, you know, struggling. And they found a way at the legislative body to allow slot machines at the tracks. Obviously, it helps support racing, which is oh so important. We in Minnesota know how important racing is, and the agricultural industry, it's far-reaching. So, you know, we need to figure out ways to sustain our business and sustain harness racing in Minnesota.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just follow up with Representative Swudzinski. So, sort of nationwide, is harness racing and standard bred industry pretty much flat? Has it been going up? Has it been going down? And are we in need of a new movie produced by a great director about Dan Patch or something?
That'd be good.
I like that.
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do like your comment on Dan Patch and pretty historical time for Minnesota. I'm not sure I have the latest figures on harness racing. However, I don't believe it's growing. It's flat. Some tracks are closing. You know, it's racing challenged.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in. We appreciate it. And we will make every effort to get up there. We're going to wait to get Representative Atkins' report when he comes back. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Barrett, Gambling Control Board. Mr. Barrett, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board. Pleasure to be here. For those that chose to stick around, I'm going to give out the winning bingo numbers for tonight at the end of my presentation. I won't tell you where they're going to be played at. But anyway, previously we handed out our annual report, newsletter we produced, and I did bring along a PowerPoint without the power. So I'll try to get through here. I know the committee's under short time frames here, but I want to give the committee, the members, a good understanding of what charitable gaming is all about. That's what our agency regulates. And simply said, our mission is twofold. One, so that citizens that are conducting or playing are ensured the integrity of the industry and the games, and that the nonprofits that we license that conduct the games continue to raise funds for charitable contributions. Brief history, we're in the midst of celebrating our 30th anniversary. Now, gambling's been going on long before 1985, but that was 1985 when the state said, let's put the regulation of charitable gaming under the state. Before that, prior to that time, it was unregulated or it was under local jurisdiction. But a lot has happened in 30 years. You can see, started out the first year about $111 million, which is significant back in 85, to over $1 billion. Currently, last fiscal year, 2014. Annual lawful purpose expenditures, that's primarily the charitable contributions and taxes, exceeded over $100 million last year. But one thing that has gone down since 85 is actually the staffing for regulation. We're right now at about a 31.5 position count, keeping an eye on a $1 billion industry. We're appropriated not from general fund money, but from dedicated fees, those license fees that we collect from the licensed vendors, the charitable organizations, the premise permits that conduct it, the manufacturers that make the games, and the distributors that deliver the products. We are, however, appropriated money. We can't just spend what we take in. You all will decide what our budget's going to be for the coming 2 years. What is lawful gambling? There's five current forms of lawful gambling. Pull tabs, which makes up the bread and butter of the industry. Over 90% of the sales activity comes from pull tabs. Something called tip boards, paddle wheels, and we're not talking riverboat gambling. This is actually the Wheel of Fortune type mechanical wheel that spin to get the winning number. Obviously bingo, and then there's raffles. Who regulates lawful gambling? We have a 7-member citizens board. 5 are appointed by the governor, 1 is appointed by the attorney general, and 1 member is appointed by the commissioner of public safety. A fairly good balance in terms of the legalities and some of the law enforcement backside in terms of the industry we regulate, as well as members that serve on our board that have had experience in the past, be it former gambling managers or industry reps. As I mentioned, the board is supported by 31.4 full-time equivalent positions. Our divisions are pretty simple. Licensing, if you want to conduct gambling, you got to prove that you're a nonprofit or you pass a background check through our licensing. We conduct compliance and site visits, compliance audits, make sure that what they're taking in is done correctly. In cases where they might be stumbling, have some problems, we'd get involved in investigations. Our investigative staff comes primarily from law enforcement backgrounds that have experience in those kinds of investigations. And then all of 3 positions that make up primarily of our administrative unit. The industry we regulate. Gambling right now in Minnesota is conducted at over 2,700 sites, primarily bars, bingo halls. 1,200 organizations are licensed, so on average each licensed org is at roughly 2.5 spots. That's the best way to look at it. We have some organizations that have as many as 20 locations. Some only have their single site. Each one of the organizations that's licensed has to have a member of that organization be the gambling manager. We'll talk briefly about some of the issues facing gambling managers these days. 3,400 exempt. This is tax exempt excluded. Relatively small gambling activity, but last year the value of that relatively small activity was over $34 million. Tremendous volume. 8,800 paid gambling employees. If we were to stack up and charitable gaming was to be a company in Minnesota, it would be, I think, the 17th largest company in the state. We have 13 distributors, 11 manufacturers making the product, and 2 vendors that are providing what we call link bingo. It's an electronic form of bingo that goes to all the sites. Next page, other gambling in Minnesota. A lot of times we'll get calls, hey, I was playing this lottery game or I was at the horse track. We don't regulate those forms. Obviously, you heard from the Racing Commission. You'll be hearing from lottery reps soon. But while we work close with these folks here, be it the lottery, tribal, horse racing, and then the sports internet are illegal, pretty much coordinated from public safety, we work close with what I consider our counterparts when it comes to issues facing the industry. You might have a bad game out there, so to speak. So we work well in that sense. There's not a lot of sharing information other than what's publicly available from the state entities. But we do work close, and I think we have a good sense of balance when there's some issues that do come up time to time from all areas of the industry. How do we regulate? Simply by licensing the organizations, the manufacturer involved in it. That includes conducting the background checks. We work close with the Department of Public Safety when it comes to those reviews. Education training. Every gallon manager is required to complete a continuing education credit, basically 1 hour. But it gives them an opportunity, especially in light of legislative changes, keep abreast of what's going on, some of the changes that are going on. Approving and testing games. Before you see a game hit the street, our lab, our staff have been testing the games, make sure that what they say in terms of the payout meets what the specs of the games are. On average, the board, we just had a board meeting today again, but on average, over 460 new games every month. I mean, the volume is tremendous in that respect. Regulatory audit, site inspections, I'd love to be able to tell you we get out to every site at least once a year. That's not the case. We're hovering around the two-year mark. We know charities like to have us out there. I know it sounds funny to have, you know, the state come in, but it's kind of that added oversight to help them, as their mission say, continue to do the right thing and earn money for their charity. As a last resort, I call it, yes, there is the opportunity legally to issue fines or suspension or license revocations, but keep in mind, this is a $1 billion industry, primarily all cash, conducted primarily by volunteers at locations that serve liquor. What could go wrong? So, with that said, though, we work very closely with the reps in the industry, and I'm happy to report the problems are relatively minimal. For a $1 billion industry, we only issued just over 30,000 in fines or suspensions to, you know, what accounts to over 2,700 locations. So it is good in that sense, and I don't want to paint a picture, but there are problems that happen. Nobody likes to see their name in a paper or in our newsletter that you also got a copy. You'll see a section dealing with some of the citations that we issued. We've actually had organizations that will call up, say, we'll pay the fine, but is there any way you can keep our name out of the newsletter? No, that's part of it, if others can learn from the mistakes. But it's not an industry that has much problems, but they're out there. The numbers, again, I mentioned before, $1.2 billion in gross receipts. That ranks Minnesota number one in the country in terms of activity. Happy to report over $56 million last year. Got to the bottom line, and bottom line by that I mean not the expenses, but what charitable gaming is all about. Youth hockey, veterans programs, outdoors, be it the Ducks, tremendous amount of activity in that respect for where the money goes. Yes, taxes are part of the industry. Just over $46 million was paid to the state last year from activity in the charitable gaming. And our regulatory budget, just actually under $3.2 million, and we rank one of the lowest in the country as a percentage of taxes and fees coming in. Now, it might be corny, but a little picture, but for every dollar wagered on a $1 pull tab as an example, it's less than a quarter of one penny that comes to my agency via the fees and to fund our regulatory authority. Pretty significant when you stack up against some of the other states and how they regulate their charitable gaming and the value of regulatory dollars compared to gross receipts. Next chart, where does the money go? Obviously, the biggest chunk goes back right back to the player in terms of the 83% prize payback. Those different five forms, on average, raffles are between 50, 60%, but the high payout games, the volume of activity with our pull tabs has the highest payback. Taxes makes up roughly 3.5%. Again, I mentioned the charitable purposes, 4.5%. Expenses, happy to report, charities have actually decreased as a percent of the gross sales with their expenses. So they're mindful of what they're spending and how they're spending it on. And again, our regulatory fee is just 0.2%. Some of the issues, and you'll hear more when representatives from the industry gets up, but the board is certainly mindful of some of the issues. And to the extent that you as legislators hear issues or have questions, happy to provide the regulatory oversight or insight in that respect. But tax rates, tax structure, It's not a simple flat tax applied. The taxes are different for depending upon what form of gaming they're being played or how much money the charities are making. We call it a combined receipts tax. I won't speak for revenue, but I know that's an issue in terms of for where the industry comes from. Sports wagering. It's the season. Has anybody got numbers on the Super Bowl coming up? Okay, good answer. That would be I would hate to see that, but that is one of the forms. But truth be told, there is a provision in law that allows for sports-themed tip boards. There's no activity going on in the state. It was passed a few years ago with the support of the board. The problem is there's a federal law that's currently prohibiting that. Folks, counterparts in New Jersey are trying to challenge that federal law. If they're to be successful, so far they haven't been. It's gone different courts of jurisdiction. But if we're to be passed and there'd be some indication that it would be accepted federally, we'd be willing to step up with the industry and have the games. But for right now, it's not allowed. Acceptance of the electronic gaming format. Again, depending upon what you've read in the paper or heard, there's been issues centered on the electronic pull-tab games, electronic bingo. Happy to provide further insight. In my presentation, I got a little more insight in some of the good examples of what's going on. We know there's issues that the industry has in terms of competition from other gambling entities, be it the Racing Commission and I should say the horse track, card rooms, lottery. All those folks play into that discretionary dollar that the customer is looking to, geez, do I want to play the horses or play the lottery, those kinds of things. We recognize that. We'd love to, and we have worked with the industry reps and legislators, but we don't think they're going to see some of the electronic gaming that they'd like to see. Our job is, you pass it, can we regulate it? But those are some of the issues I think you'll hear continue from the industry reps. Qualified gambling managers. Unfortunately, we do have an aging population when we talk about veterans posts. Veterans posts make up roughly 28% of the licensed organizations. Those folks are getting a little older, a little difficult to retain. Today at our board meeting, we had six organizations terminate their gambling license, primarily due to the fact that they couldn't find somebody within the organization to become the gambling manager and be responsible. You'll hear from the industry, maybe there's some things that can be done to accommodate or to address that, but I know the board's position has always been, if you want to take it seriously, you should be able to find somebody from within your organization to be accountable. Happy to work with them, but that's one of the concerns you'll probably hear as well. Monthly reporting to revenue. Again, not the... I'll try. I'm wrapping up. I know there's issues that the organizations have as it relates to their monthly reporting to revenue. It's important that they report monthly. What's going on? And we always say, you want to get our attention, ignore us. And by that, don't file your monthly reports. We'll know. We work close with revenue, and we get the reports here. But we know there's some ways that they could streamline some of that reporting, like make it less burdensome. We'll hopefully head that way. But you might hear about some of those concerns. Some of the issues and concerns coming out of the board, fees versus budget. The last time our regulatory fees were adjusted or even created was in 2004. They haven't changed. We're at that point now that the bank account or dedicated funds are getting down to a point, and they're actually going down, that we've submitted a fee adjustment for consideration. We haven't heard back from the governor's office. We expect to hear, like others, at the end of the month, how that budget's going to roll out. But we'll need to react to the budget recommendations or the regulatory model that we live with. And that's where, obviously, on the concerns of the regulatory models to consider if there's no fee adjustment. Transfer of lawful gambling dedicated funds to public safety. This is relatively new. As I mentioned, we rely heavily on our counterparts at public safety, if only for the criminal end of things. If we find a case or an activity that is deemed to be criminal that goes outside of our civil authority, that's when we bring those folks in to help with the investigation and carry forward the charges, what have you. But there was a portion of money in light of the electronic gaming that was given to public safety to say, hey, help the board out in terms of regulatory oversight. So there is an example, maybe two agencies doing the same thing. We still work very close, but in our placeholder and our budget package, we're trying to address those funds as relates to public safety versus for our agency. Technology assistance from Minute. Heard our counterpart of the Racing Commission talk about some of the issues budget-wise dealing with Minute as representing a small agency. And this really, I don't want to take too much away from Minute, and what it was created to do. But when you have a small agency that somewhat, you know, finds way for efficiencies and then have to follow through their procedures and numerous steps and an added cost, we're not any further ahead. So it's a point I want to make that there's an opportunity coming back before the committee just as an agency representative and what working through the administrative process with Minute as relates to our computer needs. Happy to do that. I mentioned the aging veterans. Again, 28% of the organizations, what's happening there, that's a concern. And then finally, what I would say, the hesitation of the industry to take up the electronic gaming format. We've heard, we've read in the papers, you know, what happened, it's a failure. Let me take you into the next slide or picture. I don't mean to make light of this, but you literally see two corner bars. A bar that's up at Roosevelt Bar in Eveleth and local Porky's Bar in St. Paul. You don't see any searchlights, no big neon signs, but those two sites are a couple of the biggest sites we have conducting electronic gaming. The next chart you'll see represents a bar chart for Porky's, where the solid black line represents the paper pull tabs prior to the electronic gaming, and then you see what happens after electronic gaming comes into the picture. Tremendous in terms of the activity and what that means for the respective charity at that site. And it's not a metro only. We go back, take you back up to Eveleth, Minnesota, and Roosevelt, and you'll see the similar activity. Those are just two examples of the sites that have elected to get into electronic gaming and have done very well. Unfortunately, you don't read about that in the paper or some of those things. But I just wanted to take the committee's opportunity to show all is not lost in this format. It's just a matter of continuing to work with the industry in that gaming format. So briefly, looking ahead, obviously we want to continue to work with the industry representatives, ensuring the integrity. That's always been our main focus. But we think we can do better in terms of efficiencies and how their operations are run. To the extent that we need to adapt to change, that's where we might be coming back after budgets come out. We have a policy bill that primarily clarifies some of the provisions that charities are allowed to do things. We know we got some support out there in those changes. But it's an industry kind of coming down the crossroads for regulation, depending upon what happens. And then finally, I know Mr. McCormick, House Research, was here last week. One of his key quotes I took away from that, good regulation is transparent and equitable. And I can't say enough how supportive we are, obviously, of that position. And that's where this last page leaves you with any information that you want in terms of the detail, the organizations that we license, we monitor. You can go to our website, obviously, get copies of our annual report. But there's something called the annual summary report. It lists every organization, their total sales, their prizes paid, their expenses for every organization. You can have it sorted by city. You could have it sorted biggest to smallest. Tremendous amount of information that's available to the public, and that's one of the things I think that helps the industry in terms of where does money go and how are they doing. So with that, as brief as I could, stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. We appreciate the brevity, and we ran a little bit long, but we're going to have Mr. Lund and Mr. Bone come down and hear a little bit from Allied Charities. And we will have you back after the governor's budget comes out. We're going to have more gaming fun days when we actually have bills in front of us. And that's one of the reasons we have the next two gentlemen coming out at the end. I know that they're going to have a bill, and we'll be hearing more from them. Or maybe just Mr. Lund is coming down. Come on down. And we'll jump right into it. We're going to try not to go too far over today. And members, I appreciate your patience here as we learn more about gaming. Mr. Lund, welcome back to the committee. Jump right in and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Alan Lund, Executive Director, Allied Charities of Minnesota. And thank you, committee. Really appreciate the opportunity.
And you have a slide, so?
I'm going to go without it.
Okay.
I'm going to go without it. So I believe everyone has a packet. So we'll just go without it. I did have the pages passed out, three pages of what these are donations that I just pulled 75 pages out of 438, and each of yours is different. The donations made in our communities. And I went through this list in December, and what I did was pull out only those donations that benefited our communities. So nothing where, like in my Legion, we get to help pay with utilities and those things that are all very much appreciated. Help us keep our building open so people can come and use our, nonprofits can use our building. But these are only donations that went outside of our building. 37,000 donations for 43 million and change. It was a very humbling experience for me. So I just wanted to give you a taste of that, of what.
And Mr. Lund, I believe you told me you spent about 2 weeks going through that and pulling out all the utility bills and things like that and getting down to just these, just the actual donations?
That would be true.
That's dedication.
Well, thank you very much. I'm biased, but it was really a humbling experience to see every one of those donations. And I just wanted to give you all a flavor for that. As Director Barrett had alluded to, our business has been up 4.5 years in a row. Our best year was in 2000, where we almost reached $1.5 billion. We bottomed in 2010, and we are now, the last 4.5 years, we've been up, and we've made up about half of that deficit. So we're still about $250 million shy of where we were at our all-time high, but our business is very healthy. And that's one of the messages I'd certainly like to get across. While we do have some issues and there are some clouds, our business overall is very healthy. We thank the people that help us. Paper pull tabs is still, again, the elephant in the room. Over 90% of our volume comes from paper pull tabs, with paper bingo a distant second with 5.2. But electric, the e-tabs are now in third place, which in a relatively short period of time, while they haven't performed as we would all wish they had, it's our third largest business. And the other businesses that are behind them have been around for a long time. Their Director Barrett also touched on the electronics. And we do have some barriers that we'll be coming back to you and working with. We want this to work. In my year-end letter, I said to our charities again, there's a reason for you to look at this business. You don't have the cost structure that we have with our paper. Paper is a very expensive business, and the electronics is not that way. So we are asking our people to look at that. But one of my charities wrote back to me and said, I hope we'll still be in e-gaming by 7/1/2015. We are disgusted with the paperwork needed to do e-tabs. Frankly, for us, it's not worth the headache to push numbers around to balance at the end of the month, because deposits were made and the month ends at a loss. Paper sales are going very well, best November in years. So these are the kinds of things that the feedback we get from our members, that, and we're working with revenue, and they are working with us to remove that barrier, to make it easier to file. All those numbers are out in the cloud. It should not be a big deal to get that done. So we all recognize it. We're just working together to try and get that solved. One of the realities, again, is in the tax structure. And when we look at the combined receipts, where 90% of our volume is, the charities pay a 9, an 18, a 27, or a 36. And the one thing I wanted to impress you on this charity realities page, when the charities are in the 36% rate, by the time all is said and done, for every $1,000 in sales, we get $20 to the bottom line for missions. As an example, my charity, American Legion in St. Michael, about 6 months out of the year, we're paying the 36% tax. We may take as much as $30,000 to the bank in a month and have less than $1,000 for missions when all is said and done. That's a big deal. So for those 6 months, it's very difficult for us to help our communities. So just something that, again, I know this is not your committee.
No, I know, and we appreciate it, and I don't feel like you need to rush through things. I mean, we'll go a little bit later for those that want to stay, and you will be coming back at some point, and we can get into more detail.
All right. I apologize for rushing,
nope.
too.
No, we apologize for running out of time. I blame David.
Don't blame anybody.
It's my fault.
We do have our proposed legislation for this year. We are currently working on bringing back the bill that the governor vetoed in the 2014 session. It's in the hopper in the Senate and will be in the House this week. And we hope that those bills come back to the respective committees sooner than later. And we would look for your support on those. other issues that we have coming up is, again, Representative or Director Barrett touched on it. One of the issues is, again, finding people that are willing to do the work of the gambling manager. And as Tom alluded to, in the veteran group, the managers today are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And they can't continue to do that work forever. So one of the things we're going to talk to you about is seeing if a person cannot manage more than one charity. I belong to my Legion, and I'm also a Lion in St. Michael. To me, there is no reason, if that's what those two organizations wanted, for me to run those two, to manage those two businesses, that I shouldn't be allowed to do that. As long as I'm a member in good standing of those organizations, we think that that's a viable solution to keep both those organizations in business of helping our local communities. So we're looking for some other things, raising limits on bingo sessions, bingo prizes. One of the things on e-bingo, when the legislation was passed, is in the combined receipts tax. So it can be in the 9, 18, 27, 36, depending on where your business is in any part of the year. And paper bingo has always been taxed at 8.5%. And we're going to ask that it be considered the e-bingo to also be put in the 8.5%. Because the reality is that today, very little money is getting to the state for electronic link bingo. But we know if it was at 8.5%, we know that charities would take a new look at it. And in the long run, there would be much more revenue coming in. So that's another one we'd be looking at. We're looking at raising the combined receipt levels. Currently, it's 87.5, 122.5, 157. And we're looking at going to $100,000, $200,000, and $300,000, again, for some much-needed relief for the taxes. We're also looking for the first $50,000 in net receipts for us in a given year would be tax-free. That would mirror what the exempt organizations get today. Their $50,000 is tax-free, and we think that that would be a good idea for us as well. So we'll be bringing all these items back that relate to 349 to your committee, and we appreciate that. The challenges for us, again, the aging population of the people that do our business and that support us is a concern of ours. And I tell our charities all the time that today is certainly something we need to focus on, but a large part of our job is preparing to transition this to new people. And so that we want this to continue for a very long time and not end with our generations. So we're looking at doing that, and we'll have some ideas on that. The internet gaming. We believe that gaming should be a destination sport, that you should need to go somewhere to do that. And we are not going to change our position on that. We wouldn't turn our backs on the 2,800 sites that are doing business with us today. We do know that technology will continue to be more important, more varied, and have different uses. And I could see a day where, and the technology is available today, where you could come into my Legion, or even from your home, see the games that are available that we're playing, what pull tab games we have up, what's going on with electronic link bingo, but you need to come into our site to play it. We just believe that that's how it should be done. So we hope that happens. And again, the work is becoming greater than reward. As Director again touched on, the vast majority of our people are volunteers. This is not what they do for their living. This is what they do for the love of their communities. So we need to do what we can to make it easier for them to do that while maintaining the integrity. We don't want cheats in our business. It's bad for business. We want people that are there for the right reasons and doing the right things. We welcome the oversight. And again, just adjusting to an ever-changing world. As I said, I can guarantee that about the only thing I can guarantee is that 5 years from now, there'll be things available that I would have never thought of. So we need to be able to adjust to that and change and adapt. That's all I have. I thank you again very much. Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Members, any questions? Representative Swiedzinski, any?
No, I'm good.
With that, members, thank you. And Mr. Lund, thank you. And again, I apologize for the abbreviated time, but you will be back along with Mr. Barrett. My apologies. Members, we are not meeting tomorrow. We will meet on Tuesday. And that's about all I know. With that, we are adjourned.